The start of the week and the radio was chock-a-block with compelling stories from the great women of history in Kerr to Minnie Imelda May and when Harry and Meghan met Oprah. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran and here's what you might have missed.
It was very moving last night. We put up a plaque to the banished women because they stood on the square before they were taken to mother and baby homes.
Oh God, that's a desperately grim image, isn't it? Sorry.
Well, I think, first of all, that any little girls who are left in the world, if there are, who dream of marrying a prince, are going to have serious second thoughts because there is no happily ever after, clearly.
Next thing he came back, he grabbed my crotch and he beat me 40 times over the head and I got 27 stapes in my head, broken eye socket and a broken bone in my neck.
And we'll start here on the news at one. Dr. Linda Mulligan, the new Chief of State Pathologist. As Dr. Mulligan was inspired to get involved in this area because of TV forensics dramas, Brian Dobson asked her how TV compares to reality.
To some extent, it's certainly not as rapid a turnaround time for all of the investigations. So that's a big thing that always needs to be explained when we are presenting our evidence and when we're doing our job. DNA analysis has progressed quite a bit, but we certainly wouldn't be getting results back in an hour and things like that. So that sort of dramatisation doesn't help our situation sometimes. From the point of view of the death investigation and the teams that are involved and everything from crime scenes to the Gardaí to, you know, the police investigating to the coroners, I mean, that is all fairly well represented on the TV shows nowadays, and I think that's all very, very realistic.
And of course, yeah, the technology, the science is advancing all the time. The role that forensic pathology can play is it would seem expanding, is it? And does that mean there's more and more demands on you and your office?
Medicine in general is something that continues to evolve and expand, with more and more specialist areas becoming apparent. And forensic pathology certainly is a very specialist area. Within that, then, we have to look at the other advancements, things like forensic radiology. So that's x-rays done after death, which now play a huge part in certain types of deaths that we deal with. We have to look into having that service available at a national level. There are always challenges, and that comes with the evolution of any medical specialty, I think.
Sometimes the job is described, and again going back to television, Silent Witness was one of those TV shows, but about giving voice to the victim. The victim obviously is voiceless, but part of the role of the forensic pathologist is to be able to allow them, if you like, to speak in that sense.
Yes, and that's probably the most important thing we do. So when we're doing our work, we deal with a lot of different groups involved in the death investigation process, but then we also have to deal with the bereaved families, dealing with the Gardaí, the DPP, the coroners, the defence councils. That's a very different type of approach. We have to be clear, objective, open in our communication. You know, that's the cornerstone of that relationship, and we always have to maintain our independence and objectivity in those settings. Where we meet the bereaved families tends to be at the inquests. The same principles apply with the communication. We have to be clear and open. But there's that additional sensitivity there and the understanding of the situation they're in. And so if we can tell them what happened to their loved one in the last, you know, hours, minutes of their lives, we can answer their questions and alleviate their concerns. That ultimately, hopefully, provides the family with some closure. And so that's how we're speaking. We're speaking for the deceased as part of the death investigation, but also to their relatives for some reassurance and some closure.
And just personally, Dr. Mulligan, how do you cope with situations that you find yourself in, the scenes that you have to examine, the remains of someone who has died violently? You need to establish what happened, but you also want to treat the body with respect.
100%, and everything we do is with the utmost dignity and respect to the deceased individual. So, you know, when you're dealing with a complex homicide case, perhaps a really traumatic homicide case, you do have to have a high level of clinical detachment because your focus is on the job you have to do. You have to be the voice for that person and you have to find out what happened. Part of forensics as well is having a precise and thoughtful process where you have attention to detail and you have to go into the minutest details to make sure you're covering every aspect of the death and how you're explaining it. And as I mentioned earlier, objectivity, we have to interpret our findings based on facts, and that's ultimately with a view to helping the families answer their questions and, of course, the court process as well.
But are there cases that haunt you, that you find it difficult to, if you like, achieve that professional detachment?
So not, I'm going to say, not at the time I'm doing the case. It's often afterwards, maybe, when you have a think about it. And it's not what the public might perceive, where it's, you know, the horrors of a particular case, but it may be something about the individual that resonates with you on a personal level. And sometimes that helps me to focus, I find. I use that to help me to focus, to get the answers that person deserves. So it's a different approach to, I suppose, clinical medicine, where you're dealing with living individuals on a day-to-day basis. You're getting to know this person who's deceased, and you're getting to know them very intimately. And sometimes their personal lives can reflect your personal life, and that sort of, I suppose, empathy does help you in your job. So you have to approach it like that.
You're one of a number of women who've occupied high-profile roles in forensic pathology. Professor Mary Cassidy, of course, Dr. Margaret Bolster. To what extent do you think you and they can be a role model for girls who are inspired by STEM, science, medicine as a career path?
I think, having known both Professor Cassidy and continue to know Dr. Bolster, we all were very much directed by what interested us, how we were stimulated and what our interests were in school. We're always science orientated and maths, and to be able to continue to progress that into a career in medicine and particular forensic pathology was certainly for me, it was a challenge. And I know Professor Cassidy would have talked about it as a challenge, you know, in Glasgow, and certainly Dr. Bolster has come through the ranks here as well. So don't get discouraged. You are more than capable, and if you have an interest in science, maths, technology, anything engineering, just follow your heart, and if you put in the work and you take the opportunities that are presented to you, you will get where you need to be. And don't let the cultural and behavioural systems that are in place change that.
Chief of State Pathologist Dr. Linda Mulligan from the News at One with Brian Dobson. And in the morning, that interview between Harry and Meghan and Oprah. Here's Audrey Carvel.
The much-anticipated interview with Britain's Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle was broadcast on CBS in the US last night. It's the first interview since making their decision to leave the UK and relocate to California with their young son. They spoke to Oprah Winfrey. Meghan told her she had times when she didn't want to be alive anymore. She said one member of the royal family had concerns about how dark her son Archie's skin would be. Harry said he has now been cut off financially, which is why the couple secured Netflix and Spotify deals. And speaking about his late mother, Princess Diana, he said he didn't want history to repeat itself.
I'm just really relieved and happy to be sitting here talking to you with my wife by my side, because I can't begin to imagine what it must have been like for her going through this process by herself all those years ago, because it has been unbelievably tough for the two of us, but at least we had each other.
Oprah Winfrey's Harpo Productions released a very limited number of clips from the interview. The full thing can be seen tonight on RTE2 television and the RTE player at 9:30. We're joined now by the BBC's former royal correspondent, Peter Hunt. Peter, good to talk to you this morning. You've seen and read much of what was in the interview. What's your overall impression of it and its likely impact?
Well, I think it will have a devastating impact on the British royal family. What's not clear is whether that will be a short-term one or a long-term damage. The most damaging is that suggestion of racism by a member of Harry's family. That question about how dark will be the skin of Archie. This was asked of Harry by a member of his family while Meghan was pregnant with Archie, and William told Oprah that he found the conversation awkward and he was a bit shocked. The identity of the person who asked the question isn't known. I mean, Harry also goes on to expresses hurt that no one within his family condemns some of the racist media coverage that there was after his relationship with Meghan was made public a few years ago. But, I mean, this is a charge. I mean, when we step back from it all, this is a family that provides the head of state for a multicultural country, the UK, and 15 other multicultural countries. And no amount of palace spin will be able to erase that stain in the coming days and weeks. Mm.
And in relation to Meghan Markle and what she had to say about how low she felt at that time, where she felt that she didn't want to be alive, and she said she sought help within the palace and was refused help.
Yes, I mean, the spectre of Diana hung over this two-hour programme. I mean, her son was by the departed Duchess's side for part of the programme, but from Meghan's account, and we do have to stress that this is the account of Harry and Meghan, from Meghan's account, this is an ancient institution that has had pretty brutal and painful lessons imposed on it, and they haven't learnt from it. And the lesson she was making very clear they hadn't learnt was the lesson of Diana and the mental health problems she had and the effort she made to seek help and did not receive. And now here we have Meghan in 2021 on American television telling a global audience that once again this happened, that she, as you say, didn't want to be alive anymore, had suicidal thoughts while pregnant, asked for help, told that she couldn't because she wasn't a paid employee of the royal household, and even the suggestion that it wouldn't be good for the institution if she sought such help.
And the relationship then between Prince Harry and his father, Prince Charles, it's very badly damaged.
Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinarily badly damaged. I mean, Harry looks close to tears while he talks about it, and you cannot see how it can be recovered in the short term. I mean, he talks about how he'll always love his dad, how after two phone calls from Canada, you remember they moved initially to Canada while they were trying to negotiate this sort of half in, half out, which was never going to work, sort of part-time royal, part-time earning of money, which was never really an option. But before they moved to California, he had several conversations with the Queen, but only two on the phone with his father before his father stopped talking to him and saying that he needed to put it all in writing. He felt let down. And he talks about how his father went through something similar in terms of pain. And he says that his priority is to try and heal that relationship. And also because, of course, the fact that Archie is his grandson. So, yes, it is a pretty devastating portrayal of how, from the son's perspective, of how his father has responded to what clearly has been a very difficult time for Harry.
Knowing the royal family as you do, Peter, in your work as the royal correspondent, will the palace respond to this interview?
I think it'll be very difficult for them. I mean, people were talking in the papers before it happened that they'd be hiding behind the sofa. I suspect after this interview, they've gone down into the sort of the wartime bunkers in the ancient palace castle that is Windsor. It is a truly devastating on so many levels. The racism charge, the lack of care to a person who says that she was very vulnerable, the criticism of a future king. These are really hard charges and they're quite difficult to respond to. I mean, in particular the racism one, it's just a stain that is there and it will be very hard for them to erase it. I mean, the person who emerges reasonably unscathed, apart from obviously the fact that she's the head of this family and the head of state, is the Queen. And both of them, both Harry and Meghan, speak very fondly of her. But I mean, I suppose what I must stress is that there will be people who will have watched this in the UK with utter horror, really, at how Meghan has chosen to present it. There will be people, you know, there are allegations of bullying against her, which she denies. There are people who believe that they did try everything they could to facilitate her entry into the British royal family. And I think they will be, you know, very, very hurt this morning, but it will be very hard for them to answer back.
That's Peter Hunt, former BBC royal correspondent, talking to Audrey Carvel for Morning Ireland. Then later on Today with Claire Byrne.
I'm just really relieved and happy to be sitting here talking to you with my wife by my side, because I can't begin to imagine what it must have been like for her going through this process by herself all those years ago, because it has been unbelievably tough for the two of us, but at least we had each other.
Racism, suicidal thoughts, tears before the wedding and a baby gender reveal. When Harry and Meghan sat down with Oprah Winfrey, they dropped what some in the British press are calling bombshells. Marion McKeown is US correspondent with the Business Post, and John McEntee of the Daily Mail is with us, and both were watching that interview. Good morning to you both. Thank you indeed for joining us. Marion, I'll start with you. I mean, your overall take on this two-hour extravaganza.
Well, I think, first of all, that any little girls who are left in the world, if there are, who dream of marrying a prince, are going to have serious second thoughts, because there is no happily ever after, clearly. I was quite shocked. I'm not a royal watcher. I've no interest in the royals, to be quite honest. I did watch The Crown, but under duress and in isolation. So that's been my level of interest. I will say that I was shocked at some of the revelations. For starters, I mean, even though you would have to live on Mars not to know that at one point Meghan wasn't accused of making Kate cry. And, you know, it was all a bit playgroundish. I thought all the tabloids and all the stuff about this, you know, like nonsense. But in this interview, like, first of all, this couple are clearly angry and hurt, but they come across as very likeable. Meghan seems smart. She seems down to earth. She's quick with it. She made a very funny joke about avocados when she was accused of destroying the planet by eating avocado toast. And she said, well, that was a very loaded piece of toast. You know, she's smart. But they, you know, it's hard not to feel. Initially, before the interview, Claire, I thought, oh, dear God, poor them. They live in Montecito in a big mansion and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Really, who cares? And I did come away from it feeling sorry for them, because the institution, as they refer to it, the firm, now they were very clear that they were very fond of the Queen, but Prince Charles comes in from a lashing from Harry, and it seems they were treated with a lot of cruelty, not just by the tabloids and the media who really went after them, but the allegations of racism, the fact that it was Kate who made Meghan cry, not the other way around, and this was all twisted and knowingly left uncorrected in the media. Honestly, I was shocked. I thought we'd seen it all with The Crown, but clearly there's a season 5 to come.
Well, John, what do you make of that? Marion says they're angry and hurt, but also smart and likeable.
Well, they're likeable in the United States of America when they're interviewed by Queen Oprah, but they've lost all sort of credibility and affection here in the UK. I mean, what people here are seeing is this incredibly titled, wealthy, and quite spoiled couple who chose to walk away from the royal family and are now complaining because the royal family took away their various honours and awards. And in a way, it wasn't an interview, it was a statement. I mean, Oprah Winfrey didn't ask them any questions. And a lot of the sort of headlines here are sort of quite sort of odd, in the sense that the royal family have been accused of racism. And when you see the interview, it's really a casual reference. It's a sort of... It's Meghan saying that Harry told her that one member of the royal family asked what colour the baby would be. And he was then asked about it afterwards, and he was very, very uncomfortable. It was obviously something he didn't really want to talk about. And it was elevated. I mean, suddenly Oprah sort of is completely astonished by this revelation. And the entire thing is a sort of it's a vanity project.
You think that maybe Meghan wasn't supposed to say that about being asked by this unnamed member of the royal family about the baby's skin colour?
Maybe not, but you see, it can be interpreted as racism, but it depends on the tone.
Not in your book.
But also, it people here are speculating there was a Duke of Edinburgh who's now sort of not in great form in hospital. It's the sort of thing he would say because he's completely tactless. But whether he's racist or not, another matter. But
that's John McEntee from the Daily Mail from today with Claire Byrne. And on International Women's Day, Brian Tuberty spoke to Josephine O'Neill from the CARE Women's History Group. They took to the streets to commemorate women from the town who contributed to life and care over the centuries.
Brian, what we did last night, a group of us dressed in costumes from 1918, took over the town, in bubbles of course, and erected plaques to the women of the town.
In CARE. So
in CARE.
Congratulations. What a great idea. What were the uniforms? Were they coming on?
Oh, I wore a most wonderful attire. I was like I was channeling Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, and we had Come in the Man Women, and right. yeah, it was it. Incredible.
So this was like a stealth nerds on tour, dead of night, correcting the historical record in a manner of speaking.
Rewriting the history of the town plaque by plaque.
Tell me everything.
Okay, so this all happened a few years ago. I was at a history lecture in Kerr, and I thought, I'm never going to be at a lecture about the history of Kerr women. Mm. So the next day, I met my friend Mary O'Donnell, and I said, let's go look for them. So we said, okay, we got two others, Carol and Breda, together, and we said, okay, we need to go through newspapers and archives, and then just put it all in an archive. And then after a while, we realised there's a book in this.
Right.
So we brought out this book, and then we won Tipperary Book of the Year.
Congratulations.
We had an amazing celebration the night that some women in Ireland got the vote in 2018.
Yeah.
And then I still have my hall full of more books because people are still looking for the books. And then when that all calmed down, Mary and I heard about women in England, in Norwich, who were putting up plaques to women secretly at night.
Right.
So we headed out to Norwich and we met them. And they thought we were great because we'd written a book, and we thought they were great because they had plaques. Mm-hmm. So then COVID came and we thought, this is the ideal situation. The town is empty at night. Mm. And we all have the time to go through the women and see who deserves a plaque. So that's what we did last night.
I love
it. So the town would wake up to the women of the town being honoured.
How many plaques did you put up around the place?
We have 24 plaques around the town with yeah. teams of installations because, of course, our local Gardaí, Jenny and Ray and Jenny, oversaw all of this. So it's all COVID compliant. And
yes.
then we did a walking tour. So in Kerr, if you want to walk in the footsteps of Kerr women, it'll take you about an hour and a half. You go from plaque to plaque. You
wow.
can download it on your phone, stand in front of the plaque and hear the history of that woman.
You're that sort of advanced in terms of technology.
Yes.
That's
yes.
a great idea.
It's fabulous. And so, do you know what's really amazing?
Go
somebody
on.
Said to me the other day that their son in England really missed home. He just wished he could get back to Kerr. And I thought, he will get back to Kerr virtually.
Because you can do the tour online.
Online, yes. And you can see the plaque, you can see the building,
oh.
and you can hear the audio.
I'm going to do that this afternoon in between power hosing. I'm definitely going to go on my tour of Kerr.
Yes.
I'd love
and we
that.
We have amazing women. And we're really lucky because Alice Maher comes from Kerr, the artist. So she mm-hmm. gave us her image. Our plaques are beautiful.
And Ryan wants to know something about the stories behind the plaques.
There are some of the women I'd like to ask you about because I was fascinated to get to read a brief pressy of who they are. So, for example, the Kerr female orphans sent from the
yes.
workhouse. Tell me about them.
They were orphaned by the famine and then they were sent to Australia. They'd lost their parents. Or if you just lost one parent, you were still defined as an orphan.
Mm.
And they were like a whole load of orphans left and went to Australia. Now, we followed their lives in Australia, and some of them, some of them were great-spirited women who objected to the wages or whatever, and some of them married, I'm sure, and had happier lives than they would have had in post-famine Ireland.
But nevertheless, you touch on the famine experience, and we never think about
oh,
that.
Well, the
orphans, yeah, of course.
Yes, the horror of the
yeah.
famine, and we put up a plaque to the famine women because we're lucky we have a local famine historian, Ed O'Riordan. So we had that. So we had, the incredible sadness of some of the history
yeah.
of women. Like, for instance, it was very moving last night. We put up a plaque to the banished women because they stood on the square before they were taken to mother and baby homes. We know, when I was doing the research for the book, somebody said to me, I'll tell you where you stood if you were waiting to be collected.
Oh, God, that's a desperately grim image, isn't it?
And then we went to, there's an amazing, during the War of Independence, our local chief inspector of the RIC was taken and kidnapped, and he was killed by the IRA and his wife. We have his letters that he wrote to his wife when he was kidnapped before he died. And so we put a plaque up to her because we thought, there's the other side.
Is that Lily Potter? Is that
Lily Potter? Yeah. Yes.
And she have to act as a hostage?
She went under cover of darkness to get his body back.
Gosh, what about the Mothers of the World Wars? Another amazing, and you focused in on Elizabeth Mason.
She's related to me, and I grew up listening to the story of when she got word that James was missing and how she waited and went to the post office every day hoping that there'd be news. So we put a plaque on the post office to the mothers who received the regret to inform you telegrams.
Which she got 2 years after going in every day.
Yeah.
Who was Ellen Heffernan, Josephine?
Ellen Heffernan is our keener.
What keener, as in somebody who's mourning or?
I remember my father telling us when we were young, when the last keeners attended the funeral, they were like professional mourners.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And we have a great chapter on professional mourning in our book. So you would hire them. I mean, I suppose before counselling services and that, it allowed people to express their grief.
That is fascinating.
So you hired a group of women and they cried. And I suppose it just allowed you to wail for tragedy.
And Ryan asked Josephine about Bademir.
Oh, Bademir. Oh, my God.
Who's Bademir?
Bademir. Oh, my God. She's Mary O'Donnell had heard years ago that we were mentioned, care women, in the Great Book of Lecan. So Mary headed off to Dublin and she found her. She was the mistress of a chieftain where Care Castle is now. And there was a feud and she was murdered. So then the chieftain, went off and killed the murderer with a spear. So we put a plaque up to her because we said, we were in the news then.
She inspired such passion.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And then I'd like to mention Ellen Conway.
Isn't Ellen Conway... I mean, isn't it incredible? Ellen Conway went against convention. She kept her two sons. She was in the workhouse. She worked with farmers. And one son became a millionaire. And then the other son was Kit Conway. And he was a Republican fighting in the Spanish Civil War. And, you know, it's incredible because you think of Ellen Conway. There's a monument. He's mentioned in Spain.
Yes.
On a monument. And there's also a monument to him in Ireland. So little did she know.
Remarkable, because you're talking about a woman who was bringing up her sons on her own in the 1880s or thereabouts. And for her to, God, she must, I mean, it's just out of her time, beyond her time.
Yes. Did you meet Sister Joseph?
I have not met Sister Joseph on my travels here, but I see her here. Rebel nun.
Yes. We do the history of the nuns and their contribution to care. And then we headed off down to Waterford. And we got all these letters from this great rebel nun, Sister Joseph, who was writing in the 1890s to the bishop and saying the Reverend Mother was a tyrant. And the Reverend Mother was saying the veil would be taken from her. Wow. And she said, and we put it on her plaque, her phrase was, no one is bound to obey when the superior is commanding what we never vowed.
Right.
So we put that on the convent last night.
Oh, I'd say they loved that, yeah.
I loved the fact when she died, her obituary said, her steps going gently around care, her calm face. Her calm and sweet face. And I thought, little did they know.
Yeah, well, and what about the Brosna women?
Yes. Now, I did the research for the Land League women,
yes,
the Ladies Land League in Care, and I kept coming across newspaper reports about the women who went up the mountain to take firewood, obviously for their fires, but it was Lady the Landlord's Mountain. So they were fined or threatened with prison for it. So there are three woodland areas around Care. So every time I go for a walk up there, I think, my God, think of these women. Because, I mean, the survival of their families probably depended on them.
Isn't it amazing, though? You know, they say that if the walls could speak, if the trees could speak, you know.
Yes, and what I loved was, you kept seeing the same women up in court. So I thought, yes, it kept going up.
But also fascinating, the Ladies Land League, where they took on the judge. What did you say? The judge offered to withdraw
the
charges.
Said, yeah. Oh, yeah, I loved that. When I found that, I remember it was late one night when I found that in the newspaper. And the judge offered to make an exception of the four local ladies, you know, to put the men, send the men to prison. And they said, no, do your worst, send us to jail.
See, like, the history books are very cruel to women in the sense that the Ladies' Land League, you know, that there was a Care Ladies' Land League, that the Brosna women, the people you're mentioning, they had the roles that they played, but it is very masculine history, isn't it, in terms of who did the writing of it?
Yes, and sometimes men got it, because the president of the Land League in Care began a speech at one stage, and he said, this is the first time from a political platform I am going to say ladies and gentlemen.
Okay.
Because he said the ladies in Care are an essential part of the movement.
Yes.
So obviously we were, I mean, you could see we were turning up in court, we were writing letters of protest. And I mean, we obviously, we found in 1906, we wrote to the French government complaining.
But isn't it funny if after the War of Independence, after we found our own independence, there was possibly a sense for women, you tell me now, I'm just surmising from looking at it, that this could have been a chance for us to have been very progressive in our attitudes. But that might have been shut down when kind of John Charles McQuaid kind of got into bed with the Constitution and what have you, and that an opportunity was completely missed.
Yes, we were. In 1840, Ryan, we were in Care collecting money to repeal the Act of Union. And you can see we're becoming stronger and stronger. And then our local coming them on. I mean, we were carrying gelignite. One woman played God Save Ireland while the Black and Tans were ransacking her house. Christ. She played it on the piano.
Did she really?
Yes. And then the 20s, they pushed us back into the kitchen.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. But what a terrible opportunity to miss.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
Josephine O'Neill from the Ryan Tuberty Show. And in the afternoon, Seamus Troy called Joe to talk about a savage assault he was subjected to after an operation in Cork.
You were in Cork and you were for a hospital appointment, and it happened after the hospital appointment.
No, I had an operation in Cork.
You had an operation, okay.
In Cork, and I left Cork Regional Hospital and to get the bus home.
Okay.
And next thing, I went around to the bus station and the security guy told me to go around the back. Around the back, the gentleman that assaulted me, grabbed my bag, I pulled my phone out. Mm-hmm. 3999, and next thing he came back, he grabbed my crutch and he beat me 40 times over the head.
My God.
And I got 27 staples in my head, broken eye socket, broken nose, and a broken bone in my neck, and he put 3 coins down my throat.
He put what down your throat?
3 coins.
You put 3 coins down your...
down my throat.
And Seamus, what? This is completely unprovoked.
Never met the person in my life, yeah. Martin.
And what did you think was happening? Were you in shock when this man started beating you senseless with your
I
own...
I looked up to him and I said to him, I have kids. And he just said to me, I don't care what you have. I want money. So he took my wallet, took my mobile phone. He broke the crutch off me, only for a member of the public came down and saw what happened. He ran, but there was a warrant out for his arrest at the time.
So Seamus, you're now unfortunately have been savagely beaten, and what? What did he say when he was putting the coins down your throat?
Yeah, and just said, swallow
And what was
he? He was in my back. Yeah. And he opened his mouth, my mouth.
Yeah.
And next thing, he started to beat me again with crutch. And when the Gardaí arrived, they thought it was a murder scene to a Kenta because the amount of blood I lost.
And was he caught by the guard straight away?
He was caught 25 minutes later with my blood on his jeans and he having the crutch in his hand, my wallet and my bag.
And you say that when the guard arrived, they thought it was a murder scene. Did you think you were going to die?
I thought I was dead because I was unconscious. And the leniency of the sentence was unreal.
And what did this man get?
He got 7 years, 2 years suspended, but he'll do 2 years.
How do you work out that he'll do 2 years?
I was talking to the detective in charge and the DPP, and that's what he'll do because he's in custody since last May.
Ah, okay. So you reckon he'll be out in 2022-23?
Yes, 2022 October.
Yeah. And did you see this man in court, Seamus?
No. I was allowed to go to the court. And I met two ladies in Cork that took my impact statement.
Yeah.
And my son's impact statement. And my son went to the Garda station the following day because he came to Cork to see me. Yeah. And he asked the nurse, "Where's my dad?" And she pointed, "There he is." And he said, "That's not my dad." He couldn't recognise me.
And Joe asked Seamus about the perpetrator.
And Adam Sheen pleaded guilty.
Yeah, he did. Because he said he was on drugs.
How long were you in hospital for?
Altogether 9 weeks.
Good God. And you're still suffering, obviously.
Oh, yeah, I went for an operation for my neck. For the C2 and 3 of the vertebrae.
Yeah. And what about mentally, Seamus?
I suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah. And you say your son didn't recognise you, such was the horror of the attack on you.
Oh, and my daughter, Nicole, didn't come in and they said, "That's not my dad." Because my face was so swollen. My eyes were closed. So they were.
The guard had him in custody quickly. Did he did he admit it early on that there was an issue?
There was no issue.
No, did he admit earlier on that he was guilty of the savage attack on you?
Oh, he did, yeah.
He admitted that from the get-go, okay.
Yeah.
And he never explained, insofar as it could be, his explanation was I was on drugs.
Yes.
That was his whole explanation.
Yeah.
And what about you leaving the house? Are you able to leave the house independently, Seamus?
No. I don't do the house at all.
And what was the maximum sentence available to the court for this man?
10 years. 10 years.
And did the Gardaí, given the horror of this attack on you, Seamus, as you've outlined, the savagery of it, the beating you non-stop with your own crutch to the point where the crutch actually snapped and broke, trying to force coins. I've never heard of that before. Trying to force you to swallow coins?
Oh, I swallowed the coins. I had to have an operation and have them removed.
What type of lunatic was that man?
But sure, that's why I'm trying to get it out. You know, there's victims out there and he's out in 2 years. And who's next victim?
By the way, by any chance, was he out on bail for something else?
He was out. There was a warrant out for his arrest and the Gardaí couldn't find him.
And he happened upon you?
Yeah.
Completely randomly. Saw this vulnerable man on crutches. Said, give me money or whatever. And then when you couldn't give money, he then attacked you.
No, he took my money.
He took your money.
So he did. Took my shoes. Dragged me up the road on my jeans. Took my jacket. And as I said, the Gardaí cordoned off the whole place. Thought it was a murder scene they were dealing with the amount of blood. And only for the gentleman that came down and helped me, he ran then. But the Gardaí caught him 25 minutes later.
That's Seamus Troy on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on Today with Claire Byrne, the anti-lockdown protest in Cork at the weekend. Brian O'Connell was in Cork City Centre on Saturday afternoon.
Well, the event was organised by a group called the Cork People's Convention. One of the most prominent spokespeople is a former Cork councillor called Diarmaid O'Cailla. People might remember he came to some prominence during a court case when he was prosecuted for blacking out the name Queen Victoria on Cork street signs in protest. The Cork People's Convention describes itself not as a party, says it doesn't have policies on all issues of the day, but policies are decided by citizens after discussion and plebiscite. We know there were widespread calls for Saturday's event in Cork City to be cancelled. Business leaders, politicians across the political spectrum and local leaders. But despite this, the event went ahead. There was a very significant Garda operation in place, including air support. Indeed, a number of those planning on travelling to the event didn't get to Cork. They were stopped before they accessed the city.
So, Brian, about how many do you reckon turned up?
Difficult enough to estimate, Claire, because it was held in the city centre and you had a combination of supporters, onlookers, a lot of media, undercover and uniformed Gardaí. I would say estimates of about 500 to 700 all in would be pretty accurate. Now, those present, I would say, were predominantly male. There were some families, some what I would call seasoned protesters who I would have noticed from previous campaigns. There were some who were strong advocates of alternative therapies, for example. I know some of them would have told me they were failed by the state previously in terms of mental health issues. And then there were just people who were plain curious. I suppose if I was to broadly categorise those present, it was largely people, perhaps on the margins you could say, people who shared a mistrust of the mainstream, be it government, be it medics, be it the media. One man, interestingly enough, I'd recognised because I'd actually interviewed him on the street recently enough. He was quite happy back then to be interviewed by me about something else entirely, and we'd had a very pleasant conversation then. But in the crowd, when passions were high, it was really interesting for me to see that he was one of those shouting fake news the loudest whenever mainstream media was mentioned. So I saw a really different side to him, I have to say. There were a series of speeches. Our Father was sung in Irish and then the national anthem was sung and everybody left the area. It lasted, I would say, an hour and a half perhaps. But there is obviously concern now that good work which has been done in Cork over the last few weeks and having quite low COVID cases at present, that could be in jeopardy, obviously.
OK, because this was a gathering and there were no mask wearing visible to you, certainly. Were there arrests?
Well, Gardaí say they've arrested six. Two of those were arrested in Cork City, one in the Cork North Division, one in Kerry, and a man and woman in Kildare. Now, the two arrested at the rally in Cork were for breaches of the Health Act and the Public Order Act. Most of those present, as you referenced, weren't wearing masks. Nearly all of those I spoke to said they wouldn't be taking a vaccine. Most felt the media were a big part of the problem in not telling the truth, as they said. Now, one of those I met was this man, John O'Donoghue, who's from Black Rock in Cork, and this is some of what he had to say.
This just get people back to work, back to sports and everything, and it, you know, the whole thing will fizzle out. Well, I'm not denying that there was something there at, you know, at the start, but it's you know, they're just wrapping everybody in cotton wool. It's not the way to run a country, so it's not. So, I mean, I just like to get back to a more normality, get back to doing more work, just get back to seeing sport, just get back to going back up to Dublin to visit my family. We got government officials there and they call themselves essential services. Everybody's an essential service. They can travel around the country, so can media. There's no such thing as social distancing as such. It is if you're out on the street and, you know, they don't want anyone to protest. We're listening to a lot of rubbish, we are.
A lot of people have called for this not to happen today. Business Association, Katrina Toomey and Cork Penny Dinners, people like that. What would you say to them? Are they all on the wrong side of this?
I don't know. I can't answer for other people. I just think people need to... I mean, it's just gone ridiculous the way they're treating people, treating... Families can't visit each other in hospital, you know, their loved ones in hospital or anything. It's not the way to handle a crisis. I mean, God forbid, in the Second World War, there was bombs dropping everywhere, but the government didn't wrap everybody in cotton wool. People had to go out and live. Get out and live a life. I shake hands with people, regular I do. Regular. I have to shop for myself, so I don't wear the mask whatsoever. I know they won't even let people go into a shop without a mask. Having said that, I do go in without a mask, and I have been pulled up over it.
Well, that's John there. Then Brian spoke about some of the other people he met at the protest.
Nearly everybody I spoke to told me they didn't trust media. Repeatedly, people would come up to me before we chatted and say, are you going to tell the truth today? Three women, for example, approached me at one point, and it was clear, really, no matter what I said in response, it was just a chanced event and to provoke a reaction. And time and again, I was told COVID was just a seasonal flu. These were the phrases people were using. They were quoting quite obscure studies. They were talking about online information, which would have revealed huge conspiracies that I was deliberately not reporting on, they were telling me. Many of them were filming me while I was doing interviews. And then later, some people did get, I suppose, quite abusive around their hatred of media and their mistrust of government, big pharma, neoliberalism. These were all common themes that kept coming up throughout the day.
OK, and we'll talk about those in more detail in a moment. But you did meet someone who also told you that his mother was a nurse.
That's right. And I mentioned neoliberalism earlier. This man told me he studied in university. He was challenging things like neoliberalism, he said, since the 1980s, and it transpired, as you said, that his own mum was a nurse on the front line.
First of all, we never did a cost-benefit analysis in this country when we locked down. There was no compassion, no empathy, no semblance of human rights, no accountability. We don't do accountability very well in this country.
And were you someone who at the start thought, OK,
no,
let's see where this goes? You were against it from day one?
Yeah. Not from day one, but I'm a sceptic. And I know I believe in people, but I believe institutional power is very dangerous. And I think that that's coming to the fore right now.
Where do you think your scepticism came from?
I think I've always been a sceptic, but I think that people, and I'm not saying you personally, but the institutions that are running the mainstream media in this country and the institutions that abide by that, they're trying to turn this into a left versus right narrative. Left and right, that is completely false. This is authoritarianism versus freedom.
Is your main disagreement with the economic policies, or do you feel it's with the health policies?
Everything. Yeah. The whole thing is corrupt to its absolute core. There is mass movement growing here. A peaceful mass movement, but absolutely, I will not take the vaccine. My mother already has. She's a nurse. Look at the amount of guards around here in this spot. Do you think that's a good thing? Honestly, do you think that's, like, I know it's not due for you to give your opinion. I don't, personally. There was a helicopter going overhead here. There's guards all over the place. When's it going to stop? When are people just going to forget about this division and realise that society is tearing itself up? The economic point of view, I studied business in college. I'm sorry, but does anybody have any idea the national debt that has accrued, the rise in taxes that's going to occur, the way they're now talking about universal basic income? What is going on here? Have we all lost our complete marbles? It's absolutely nuts.
Okay, Brian, that's one view. And you spoke to a couple of other people as well. What were they saying?
Yes, I mean, speakers were saying the government was spinning the figures. That was the accusation, that the disease was a minor cause of death. Some people to attend were the twins, Katrina and Pamela Mackey. They're members of the Cork Camogie team. They took issue with the lack of sport and how this was impacting on people's mental health. Separately, I was also asking some of those I met, where were they getting their information? Some did say social media platforms like Twitter, like Facebook, but they felt that these sites were being increasingly censored, as they said. Some attempts we know are being made on those sites to tackle misinformation. Now, some told me they were using a social network called Gab. That's a site actually that says it promotes our social media network free speech, but it has been linked to far-right activists, to white supremacists, to extremists. It was one of the sites, the allegation is, that protesters used during the storming of the Capitol building, for example, in the US, and it has been accused of creating an echo chamber of extremists and violent views.
Brian O'Connell's report from Today with Claire Byrne. Never meet your hero unless your hero is Imelda May. On the Ryan Tuberty Show, Hannah Roddy was catching up with Ryan after a very long time.
We met first on the toy show in 2011. I think the first time I met you was at the dress rehearsal the day before.
What are your memories of that?
I remember I gave you jelly beans.
Which is always the way to my heart.
Of course.
So it was a great way to say hello to me, for sure. And then you sang because you were so very distinctive. I remember that because of the outfit.
Yes, I was Minnie Imelda May on the toy show.
And you sang Johnny's Got a Boom Boom.
I did indeed.
Amazing. Here's what you sounded like. You're gonna shrink out love. How old were you singing that, Hannah?
I was, I think, 9 years old. So it was exactly 10 years ago.
So you're obviously, what, 19 now?
Have you hit 19? I'm 19 now, yeah.
And tell me what news you have for me.
So, basically, as you heard there, I was singing Imelda May back then. And now I am featuring on her new song, Made to Love, doing backing vocals. Which is on her new album, 11 Past the Hour.
Congratulations. I mean, that is that's a big leap from toy show being her to album appearance, backing singer for her.
I know, right? It's absolutely mad.
It's mad. You met her after the toy show, didn't you? A few days later, she saw you.
I did, yeah. So basically, after the toy show, her team reached out to me and were like, Imelda would love to meet you. So they got me tickets for her show, which I actually think I had tickets for the show already.
Yeah.
But yeah, they got me tickets and I got to meet her backstage and she was nothing but lovely, thank God. So, yeah.
And how did you end up on backing singing all these years later?
So basically, my uncle is actually on the board of trustees at the London Irish Centre.
Oh, I know it well. Yeah, they do great work.
Yeah, they really do. Mm-hmm. And basically, he was at an auction just right before COVID hit and one of the things that was up for the auction was a recording session with Imelda. So he actually won it and then he got talking to her because she was there. And he was like, do you know, my niece is actually the girl who sang Johnny Got a Boom Boom on the toy show. Yeah. And she was like, oh my God, yeah. So basically, I remember after that, I think they were going to invite me to go to Trafalgar Square and I would have been singing a song with her on St. Patrick's Day, but obviously because COVID hit, I couldn't go over. But that would have been great. Oh. But anyways, so it was just meant to be like a normal recording session, but obviously with them knowing that I was Minnie Imelda, they actually asked, do you want to be on the album? Like, do you want to do backing vocals? And I was like, yeah, definitely. So yeah, that's kind of how all that
amazing
happened.
Amazing. Well, I hope when the COVID thing gets the hell out of Dodge, she can still come good on that promise, if you like, to sing with her. And, you know, that is just on hold, like so many things.
Oh, absolutely. Your team actually said that she'd love to meet me when all of this is over.
There
and
you go.
Hopefully we can have a catch up.
It's Hannah Roddy for the Ryan Tuberty Show. And on Morning Ireland, the rollout of vaccines to medically vulnerable people begins this week. Here's Audrey Carvel.
The HSE say they plan to begin vaccinating people aged between 16 and 69 and who are said to be at very high risk of developing severe COVID-19 later this week. There's thought to be around 160,000 people in this group, which includes those actively or within 6 weeks of receiving cancer treatments or surgery, chronic neurological conditions, respiratory diseases, uncontrolled diabetes, inherited metabolic diseases, intellectual disabilities, obesity, and sickle cell disease. Also included are those who are immunosuppressed due to disease or treatment, such as transplant recipients. Karen Moynihan is in this group, and she's been telling our reporter Killian Sherlock that she doesn't yet know when she will get the vaccine.
I don't know, I started to feel like maybe I was jumping the gun by getting in touch with my GP and kind of asking at my renal clinic, like, what's the story, when are we, who's going to be vaccinating and when does it happen? But just nobody seemed to know. So like I would have been in with my renal clinic last week. And when I asked them, they reckoned it would be my GP. But then when I got in touch with my GP later that day, they didn't really know either. So, and then in the middle of all that, an announcement had been made that we were definitely starting with cohort 4 this week, and it just seemed like this announcement had been made, but nobody who was actually going to be doing the work seemed to know anything about it, which was a bit weird. Yeah, so it's really just the fact that I've been kind of asking myself, really, and asking people and getting in touch and sending my emails to try and find out what's going on, because otherwise I really wouldn't have heard anything from anybody about it. You know, announcements are made, but then there's no kind of follow-up with it. So I suppose it's kind of just trying not to get my hopes up on it too early.
That's Karen Moynihan there. Well, people with chronic kidney disease or on dialysis will also be vaccinated. As part of this group, we are joined by Colin White, who is National Projects Manager with the Irish Kidney Association. Colin, you're welcome to the programme. The HSE say they're going to start vaccinating around 10,000 people who have neurological conditions, and they say that will happen later this week. Do you have definitive information about when people with kidney disease will get the jab?
We don't at this point have this information, and I think just to follow up on some of Karen's points there, that we need to perhaps temper our expectations that, as you've said, there's about 160,000 people in this revised group four. We know that 10,000 vaccines are going to be given out this week, but I think the biggest anxiety for patients is where and when and who's going to contact them, because there is that confusion between, is it the GP, is it the hospital? And I think we accept that maybe some of the precise detail, knowing my name is John, when am I getting vaccinated, can be challenging. But I am part of the dialysis group, or I'm part of the transplant group, the cancer group, whichever. Can I have some clarity on at least who will be contacting me? And likely where I'll be getting vaccinated.
Okay, so there's no such information at the moment.
Primary information. Not certainly within our community, we have yet to be informed.
Dr. Colm Henry at the NPHET briefing last week said, and from what he was saying, I mean, compiling that list of who should be vaccinated, it sounds like it will take some time. It's a pretty significant task.
I think a lot of the information is there, like particularly for transplant recipients and people on dialysis. Like the definition for inclusion in group four is very clear, it's and unambiguous. But it's a matter of pulling together a huge amount of data of people who are based all across the country, and then determining within the 160,000 people who goes first, where they get the vaccine, when they get the vaccine. And then the other question that is also being asked is which vaccine? Because the recommendation for group four was that if you can get it without more than a 3-week delay, that you should expect to get the mRNA vaccine. But then the announcement that things were starting this week seemed to lead with it being the AstraZeneca vaccine, and patients obviously have questions in relation to this. So I think the issue from a patient perspective is more to do with communication and managing expectations with clear communication. And I think equally, from what we're hearing, both the hospital sector and the GP sector need clear communication.
That's Colin White, the Irish Kidney Association's National Projects Manager, for Morning Ireland with Audrey Carvel. And that's it for Playback Daily. Back tomorrow with more, so mind yourself, and I'll talk to you then.